This year marks the 20th anniversary of the pilot airing in November, and we said we've got to celebrate this. The anniversaries are worth celebrating, and we want to celebrate this. And today we have, as a special guest on our podcast, Rodney Charters. Rodney, I like your name. My dad was named Rodney as well, and I always liked the name. Uh-huh. Welcome to the podcast today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So let me start with this. Justin and I are both Canadian.
Yes.
And from what we understand, Canada had a role in your career.
I spent early life. I went to film school in England. I was born in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. I traveled across Russia on the Trans-Siberian in 1968. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And, went to the Royal College of Art in London, ended up in Toronto, and found that I could work before you had to. They closed the border 6 weeks after I arrived.
Wow.
And I was able to get a job. After that, you had to go back to your original country and file a desire to work, you know. So I lucked out incredibly. 20 years or so in Toronto, surrounding, working for CTV mostly, CBC.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Documentaries, W5, Live It Up, a resounding success.
I remember that, yeah.
And I did the odd documentary on and off, and eventually got dragged into Toronto's burgeoning runaway film industry.
Right.
And Mark Irwin, who was the fly, you know, he was Cronenberg's man, a cinematographer, and he dragged me in to shoot a thing called Youngblood, which of course is an epic hockey movie.
Yes.
One of the greats.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I shot alongside him doing second unit, freaking out at 96 frames per second, trying to follow the puck on the ice with a 300 mil.
Right.
This is a nightmare.
Yeah.
So that was trial by fire. And then Mark left to go to America because David didn't have a script, and he was getting frustrated. He wanted to work. So he left, and he'd been doing a late night CBS drama. And I took it over. He just handed it to me. So it was trial by fire. I mean, I had been shooting 16 my whole life and mostly without a crew, you know, one man band, loading your own mags, all over the world shooting for the CTV network. And then suddenly here I am on a drama set with no idea how to behave. But subsequently, once I'd moved, you know, got attracted, it came down here and did Nash Bridges. It was my first big American show. But I shot Psycho 4 for Mick Garris in Orlando. And so I was becoming an L.A. kind of resident, and eventually I moved. So there I was doing a job that had gone under at Fox. And then Fox said, hey, we've got this other show. Go and meet Stephen Hopkins. It's this thing called 24. And of course, I got to read it and thought, oh my God, this is good stuff. And Peter Levy had been the DP on the pilot, and he didn't want to do the series. He wanted to go off and do movies and so on. And so Stephen and I kind of had a discussion, and Fox were pushing at that time for us to go digital. And Stephen just bluntly said, over my dead body.
Not going to happen.
Not going to happen.
Not going to happen.
So,
wow.
I said, okay, I have no problem with film. You know, we want to do this. He said, okay, I want the first scene I remember doing where it really sunk in that we were on a new trajectory. I mean, the pilot was a viewable thing, and it was amazing, and Peter had done a great job, and they've continued to work together over the years on and off. He said, I've got this five-minute scene. I want to cover it in one. Eight cameras handheld. We never had any wheels. We were always if we were on sticks, we had a floaty head. And we used Zooms a lot, and the boys were encouraged, Guy Skinner on A and Jay Heron on B camera, usually on a really long lens called the Widowmaker, because it was such a dangerous lens. It was 160 to 400 mil at 2.8, and we would often use a 1.4 extender to get out to 600 mil, and we would use that inside. So at 30 feet, you could have a full mouth on the frame, and you're focus pulling nightmare. So we were one of the first to use our systems for focus assist and that kind of thing. And Guy would be moving with Kiefer all the time. Kiefer would drive the energy of the ship and the focus of it. And I realized that it was very verite shooting that we were doing. It had drama components. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating that the movie that won this year for cinematography was No Man's Land. Eventually, a verite coverage of people who, within the very scene, didn't even realize that Frances McDormand was an actor.
Fascinating.
I just read that this morning, and I thought, oh, how wonderful, because so much of what we see now and consume as viewers is generated by people's cell phone footage posted on TikTok or on Instagram, and people are making the most amazing little stories on their own with their own equipment. It's not a barrier anymore. And I remember at film school, you didn't touch a camera unless you were in a film school, because God knows you could never afford it. And nobody in the profession was going to let you near their gear unless you were sweeping floors and you took 10 years to come up through the ranks.
Right.
And now with digital learning on a worldwide basis, no language necessary, you can learn to make and shoot your own material with an extraordinary degree of sophistication and internal knowledge, and you're safe to tell your own story. And it's a whole changed world. But in Kiefer and the energy that he gave to the scene, in covering him, we explored a whole new dynamic of how to shoot drama at that level.
Hmm.
And the 180 whip pans.
Yeah.
Very, very close work with the A camera right up alongside Kiefer with a widish lens handheld and sitting on a butt dolly and moving with him. It, of course, brings back memories. It was an extraordinary ride. When you're in the Los Angeles area as a cinematographer, you're not often, longevity is not something you think about.
Right.
You're on the show closes, and it's a very sad occasion, and everyone disbands, and you may never see these people again, and there's 200 people on the team.
Right, yeah.
But when Kiefer signed a three-year deal for $15 million with Fox, we all went 50 miles.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it was a way to put your kids through college, and it was a good time. And I remained very good friends with everybody on the team. We invented a lot of very interesting stuff, which is still used in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first things that we did was we realized that we had to shoot a lot of driving, flying in helicopters. And it was all in real time, and it took place mostly in the valley in LA, and it was all sodium light, and there were helicopters flying, and it was all pretty wild. And even the first episodes, I remember driving with Kiefer in a car doing dialogue on a freeway at night while a helicopter photographed us from above.
Wow.
And they wanted to integrate all of this. And I had to push the film to 1,000 ISO and use our widest lenses. Were really only 2.8s at that time. We didn't have high speed primes, and they were all zooms, and we wanted to just keep on shooting. So that kind of thing just became necessary. I realized that we had some fairly bright projectors and we could get rear screens.
Okay.
So eventually we started with one. It was about a 10 by 16 screen, quite an expensive screen, so that you didn't see the hot center in the projector. Or we would put 9 DV cam cameras around a good luxury sedan, so they had good suspension. And
right.
We would drive the route that we wanted to be see outside the window. And then we would come on a day and we would suspend the ceiling so we didn't see the stage. We put a black up and we put the car in there on go jack so that we could spin it around and shoot the different angles. And then we just moved to the screen, changed the plates for a side angle, a front angle, a rear angle. And we started doing that. And of course, this developed into 2 screens, and we got pretty sophisticated in it. And eventually we used Canon cameras, 5D Mark IIs or 1s, I think they were in the beginning.
Yeah.
We used those together, the plates digitally. And Sam Nicholson at Stargate helped us integrate all of this material if we needed green. But we did all this live, and then it was done. So we would sometimes do, I think our maximum was 15 pages of dialogue in different cars and in a helicopter and in a boat.
Yeah.
We did it day and night. And so that was pretty innovative. And everybody came to us eventually and said, how were you doing that? How did that happen? Because it's so much more efficient to do. And of course, now we're getting into video walls where the video wall is playing back the plate. And you have interactive lighting. so that if you go through a dark period, the lights all dim, and the background, of course, is showing you that dim, and it's become so realistic and very convincing, a la Mandalorian.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
It's a vast panel to do car work. You just need one on one side and one on the other, so you get reflectivity in the windows that you're shooting through. And so that was one of the things. But there were a bunch of other things. We had a thing called bat wings that we used on Kinoflows that trapped the amount of light. You'd snap them in on the tubes. Bat wings, the butt dolly, which is still out there.
It's a great name.
You can buy them for $800 at Film Tools, and everybody has those. All the assistants glide around on them because they're a beautiful handheld kind of device for floating.
Right.
The cloud, the grip cloud, a big floating helium balloon that was only 2 feet thick that you would take up to the top of a space, and you would, the helium would take it up and you would cut the cloud, and the sun would diffuse through this thing, and you had this beautiful, and they're used all over the world, although the price of helium is going through the roof. My people went on to become DPs on their own. The latest one is Anthony Vietro, who's now shooting for John Wells and doing Animal House. And so
oh, okay,
on.
Yeah.
And so the Lisa Weigand, who does all of the Chicago Fire stuff now for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
She was an early, I did a competition with six people in the LA area. We want someone to shoot extra footage. Show me your reels. And I chose Lisa. And Liza Weigand, and she's gone on to become a DP on her own. So there's a lot of stuff that came out of 24 that I think was fantastic. And if Kiefer was himself very innovative in the way he rewrote all the shows.
Yeah, yeah.
The white scripts in a cupboard and said, I keep them as a guarantee that you'll never come back to me and see that that's how you wrote it, because we're rewriting all this stuff. He did that every day in the beginning of a scene. He would change it, you know, and we had to be very, very nimble on our feet, because we'd had a plan in our head, but he'd come in and say, no, I would never put my back against that wall.
You got to reconfigure everything to be on the fly.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things we talk about, we have these super fan groups, and we talk about, you know, some people that have become fans recently, other people that like me that watched it from the beginning. I was watching it. One of the things that comes up several times is that we never felt like we were watching a TV show. We felt like we were watching an extended movie.
Yes.
So when I look back now, and I watched the original episodes on a 27-inch tube TV, I'm now watching them on Disney Plus on my 55-inch. And it's beautiful. To think that it translated from that to now is
film was, you know, was retransferred in HD. So you do get an HD image. It could be retransferred in 4K, but they're too cheap to do it.
Right, right. The technology's changed so much. Have you gone back and watched some of the original episodes? And
yes, I take little bits every now and again for real.
They hold up beautifully. Thank you.
They do.
Hold up beautifully. But it's a tribute to film.
And
one of the things, of course, at the very early days, we were still shooting 4:3.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 16:9 version. They had to go back and rescan the first episodes.
Right. Yeah.
But film holds up, and it's a beautiful. We were threatened with digital. We shot comparison tests.
Mm-hmm.
And Kiefer looked at himself side by side, and he said, "Not my face on that system," and it was the digital. So that was the end of that.
Sure. Yeah.
20 years later has aged very well in terms of the cinematography, and it's still everyone we talk to, it still works, it's still popular, it's still loved.
It didn't look like anything else on TV.
Stephen Hopkins was the guy who set the tone. He did 12 episodes the first year, and by episodes I mean he basically shot the whole season, because we blocked and shot two episodes at a time. So we were shooting 90 minutes.
Right.
That's why it had a feel of it being a feature. Mm-hmm. The fact that Kiefer stayed in locations for a long time. It had that lovely quality of you just ran with the energy, and the energy drove you. And they were all story points. And then there were parallel stories. So the multi-screen thing helped tremendously.
Right.
And the ticking clock. Yep.
And, you know, John Cassatt picked up on that and ran with that, and he did the most of the episodes in the end, and he's a good filmmaker. it, one of my highlights, of course, was directing Kiefer as well. The most extraordinary experience. Yeah. And, you know, Guy stepped up and McGatt stepped up and helped. You know, they were the cinematographers on Note. And it was there's nothing like being a director.
I was going to say, what was the difference for you from of directing an episode?
I realized that I had to give up. I actually went to acting classes and took guidance from people who were teaching actors. And
okay.
I'd not been an actor myself. And so how you make that crossover and how you communicate tone and annoyance and subtlety and so on, you see it in people like Nomadland. You see her work, stuff that she's doing behind the scenes, the delicacy and the gentleness. We had none of that on our set. Our sets were total chaos.
Sure, yes.
Tiny moments, then you could grab Kiefer's attention.
Yeah.
And he's a very intelligent, focused individual who totally got it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, you're just kind of nudging him around about, you know?
Yeah.
There is some priceless stuff that you can't talk about. I
mean, right. The hidden stories.
It was the most amazing experience. And it got me into the ASC. One day I'm standing on set and Owen Roizman, a famous American cinematographer, is on set saying, "Hey, we just came to watch you work." And next thing I know, Peter and him and another Canadian, Mark Owen, were writing letters for me. And they got me into the ASC, which I'm forever grateful. That was a stepping stone to many different things. And,
wow. You know, well, as a cinematographer, what was the challenge of shooting a real-time show?
They were exceptional challenges, but I had been schooled as a documentarian to realize that when you go into an environment where you don't have total control, and yet things are going on that you have to capture, you may have an opportunity to augment the lighting, to assist it if it's too dark, or to switch things off, or to ask, can we shoot later in the day in this room because the sun will come in and do nice things for me. So all of that was thinking that was going on as you're blocking these sets. And I had a fantastic gaffer called David Saint-Ange and my key grip, Anthony Vietro. And together we would orchestrate this in advance. Although interestingly, I never went on scouts unless it was a huge problem. They would videotape and we'd have discussions. But I shot all of the episodes, whereas today, generally you share a show with two DPs.
Right.
One is prepping while you're shooting. And that does allow for a little bit more control, but in the end, you don't own the images, all of them, because every other show is somebody else.
Right,
and
right.
It takes away a little bit of that. I'm proud of the fact that I did 186 or 94.
Yeah, it's quite the number.
Yeah.
That is quite the number. Yeah, absolutely. And again, from an audience standpoint, the idea that this was not necessarily TV like we've seen it before, we were in the action and you were a big part of putting us into the action because the urgency and the pulse, as you know, as I've heard before, was all there.
You had brilliant, absolutely brilliant operators.
Yeah.
And they were my eyes.
Yeah.
And I was the overviewer, making sure that everything was in the right place for them and so on. But I have to give huge credit to Guy Skinner.
Mm-hmm.
He developed a relationship with Kiefer where they were in synchronicity. That kind of behavior between the two of them. In long takes, we would use 16-minute magazines, 1,000-foot mag on the XL Panaflex, and we would shoot those 16 minutes in maybe two takes on a scene. Why go once and then go right again?
Yeah.
So that kind of fluidity of motion where you could carry a shot a lot longer than we actually cut it. And the frantic energy was this vicious cutting, bang, 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 bang. Sometimes I think we got up to 1,500 cuts in a 45 minutes.
Wow.
Crazy pace.
Yeah, yeah.
That pace and the multi-screen drove you with an energy that was palpable. And we had a lot of older people say, you know, thank God for the commercials because I'm just going to have a heart attack.
Well, yeah. I mean, I was from the day, certainly from the first and second season of the 6-week gap of where, you know, we'll be back in 6 weeks and something cataclysmic would happen. And then we'd have to wait 6 weeks to find out what was going to happen next. That was torture. That was, that was work.
Thankfully for me, I didn't have that. I got to binge it.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, that, of course, we started the binge watch.
Absolutely.
I remember going to Japan. I was wanted to go. It was time off between seasons, and they asked me if I'd do some promo, and I ended up doing something like 9 interviews in a day in Tokyo. And I was just a cinematographer. I don't even think I directed at that point. It was right. early days. But going into a video store, and there was 100 yards of cassettes on the display, only of 24.
As it should be.
They would only let them out once a week. Online. You couldn't binge watch. Fox got smart, and they said, what if we put out a whole box set of this thing? Yeah. And they seemed like gold.
That is how I got it.
At the White House one time, we were shooting in Washington, and Rice, we met her on the stairs, and we were introduced. John Cassar and I got the big tour.
Right.
And she said, oh, yes, we have box sets on Air Force One.
Like crazy. You've arrived.
It was insane. How it took hold post 9/11, of course.
Right, and right.
We watched the towers come down on the floor with Kiefer on the set shooting and realized this was a brave new world and we'd have to change things. And we did have to modify the edit. The show had already been, it was the pilot and it had to change. The girl jumped out of the plane and we had to make some modifications.
Yes.
But from that day on, you knew that people really were glued because they wanted to understand what terrorism was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We had a map in the writer's room, which we'd gotten from the CIA secretly, which listed all the cells in America with their names and who they knew and where they were and what part of the country.
Wow.
And we were just dealing with dynamite the whole time.
Yeah, yeah.
And consequently, when Kiefer, I remember distinctly, Kiefer squatting, an AK-47 is put to his forehead. And Stephen Hopkins said, put the gun to his forehead. And we said, sir, you can't. You're not allowed to point a weapon at, you have to go for the throat or down in the shoulder. So put the weapon against his temple. And we shot it in profile. I said, this is, of course, we shut up about it. Next day, there were lawyers from Fox on set out in the valley, driven all the way out there, which they never do.
Right.
And they said, you can't do that. And both the producer, Joel Surnow, and Hopkins said, we are leaving the show unless you leave this alone.
Wow.
And they were terrified initially because they were worried about the big advertisers, and then all of a sudden the big car companies started coming in and they had no problem selling advertising after that. It was a very strange dynamic because it was very Democrat, the way we made it. A lot of Democrats,
right
but there were the administrators and the running people in the show, and a strange dynamic.
Yeah. I mean, you were heavily involved with 24. You had a very important role. Do you think 24 is a show that could easily be revived in this day and age? What are your thoughts?
Well, we've had a lot of emulators of this kind of show.
Yeah.
Some of the best come out of Europe, to be honest, out of England. From a subject point of view, these are very dangerous times, more dangerous than when we were doing our thing. It was just terrorists and us. Now half the terrorists that we're worried about are internal in the country.
Right. Yeah.
So much polarization. Yeah. I don't know how you would survive putting it out there. The style, the filmmaking style, is being adopted in spades by everyone who wants to tell that kind of story. I think filmmaking has a huge role to play in bringing about understanding, and we are in dangerous times. The racism in America is so to the rest of the world, it's unbelievable that people are behaving the way they're behaving. Yet these are good, decent people who feel in their hearts that they're doing the right thing, and yet they continue to deny voting rights to African Americans. I come from another culture. I was brought up in a socialist society in New Zealand. It was the number two country on the planet after the war in the 50s. Very wealthy. Everybody had big DeSotos and big American cars, and everybody had two cars. You know, it was crazy. I got my teeth done. I got all my hospital. I got all my education, you know?
Right, yeah.
And it's very strange for me to stare at this and say, no, the Jeff Bezoses of the world are the ones that should be running things, and this trickle-down economics does not function. I'm sorry. The rest of the world laughs at us, really.
Yeah. I mean, we're in an interesting position as Canadians, too, to kind of be. I mean, I border Detroit, so I'm right in Windsor. And, I have the exactly what you said, the polarization is right at my back door. And, I think, if anything, the dialogue. One of the things that really has come up, too, in the last several weeks is the concept of art being able to show us something that we haven't seen yet. Certainly David Palmer as president is something that we hadn't seen before. And now we saw it in real life from 2008 to 2016. We saw a black president.
So, convinced that was because of our show.
Yes, I agree. I go back to, there's something else in your resume that I loved when I was a kid, because it was the first time I'd ever seen it on screen, was Mantis.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Mantis was the first time I had ever seen a black superhero on screen, and I watched all those episodes religiously. I was just fascinated by that.
That was a fun project. I mean, there've been a bunch of projects that I thought would have, in another era, might have stayed on the air.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Some audiences, and now we have the whole world's television that we can watch.
Exactly.
It's pretty astounding, and you know, subtitling's automatic, and it's just an astounding situation.
Things are opening up. Things are changing. You know, to contrast all the other polarization, there are some things that are changing. But I think without, say, Mantis at least taking the shot then, I think progress, and 24 obviously showing David Palmer, progress, you know, helping us to visualize something we hadn't seen yet. And that's, to me, what's exciting about why we still champion 24. I mean, some of the things that we, you know, some of the ideals.
That's for show from Fox's point of view. I mean, that's to be understood. We were pushing $5 million an episode.
Mm-hmm.
In that time, we were one of the highest paid shows that was, you know, and they would throw $500,000 without even thinking about it, us, in addition to blow something up.
Well, that's my next question. You blew up a lot of stuff. What was your favorite thing to blow up on the show?
Well, the favorite thing was we wanted to use the Navy. And the Navy wanted us to use anything we wanted, but we never went to sea, except we did go into a nuclear submarine for 3 days.
Right.
Down south. Mm-hmm. That was unbelievably fascinating, with two admirals standing pressed up against, shaking hands like this, because there were people all around you. You know, it was crazy.
Wow.
But the thing that really was a buzz was the F-16s. We wanted them to strafe the LA River and send a rocket into a helicopter.
Was that Stephen Saunders?
I can't remember.
Yeah, it was the guy was trying to get away, and they called in Oh, love that scene.
Yeah, and so we had these. First off, we had to get permission to clear LA. You know, people can't remember now. There used to be 50 planes on approach to LAX at any time, day or night.
Right.
They're on that runway going, the run into the airport took you right across the LA River. And we wanted to fly looped F-16s underneath them. So we had to get FAA permission from Washington.
Sure.
It happened in 20 minutes, we got permission.
All the loopholes and everything, the paperwork, all got cleared.
I'm sure the fuel alone was $50,000. I think we had to pay for it, for these two jets to make 12 loops.
That shot?
Radius and coming up the river.
That shot was worth it.
10 cameras. And brilliantly, my operator, Guy, was on Kiefer on the radio ordering the attack. In the foreground, lying on his side in the LA riverbed, and behind him you see the jets coming up the river. Off them, as then we put in a simulated rocket and we whipped to the helicopter, and it blew the thing up with more plastic explosives than I've ever seen used in my life. Tore this helicopter apart, but it was a one-off.
We
did that twice. That was the guts of our kind of visual concept, that we would say, this is going to blow the shit out of this thing, but we're on Kiefer and we might just whip just in time to get the tail end of that thing. But we are not going to be there waiting.
It
was all done with this gut feel of the energy of the operator pushing and shoving you and dragging you in the direction of where the story was happening. You know.
Well, I mean, I watched it when it aired live, so I did not have the luxury. There was no TiVo back then. There was no rewinding. You just literally, I remember sitting it in front of the TV, just jaw dropped, going, oh my gosh, how am I going to see that again? That was a movie scene. That was incredible. Yeah, it was, yeah.
So much. You know, with streaming now, a lot of that kind of tension is gone because you can just click and rewind. And
right, yes.
What did they say, you know? It's really an astounding period of time for television. And I'm glad it happened and it's around and, you know, very, very well regarded worldwide.
Disney Plus picking it up around the world. I mean, Canada qualified for that. So we have it streaming now in Disney Plus. Oh, it looks so good. But what films did you grow up watching?
You know, we had 4 cinemas in our little town of 15,000 people. So that was a testament. Film was big in our town, but there was no television.
Okay.
And, you know, I was not so much conscious of it as my father was a cinematographer. He was a still photographer, but he ended up Super 8, you know, 8mm Super 8. And then he'd been a photo reconnaissance guy in the Second World War in Guadalcanal.
Wow.
Against the Japanese. And he took anamorphic 16mm. And of course, I ended up borrowing his camera to make my first film. And I was in films with him. So for me, it was a very different kind of thing. I understood cutting without really understanding it, you know.
Right, right.
And so it wasn't until I went to university and started really watching films. You know, Blade Runner, late in life, I was already a shooter. But Blade Runner is still one of the most memorable experiences in a cinema.
Yes. I remember seeing that in the theater. And that was one of the first times at the end of the movie nobody got up. Yeah. Everybody just kind of sat there and just kind of just drank it in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard to recreate that.
Sure. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
It's been a long time since I've been so moved by the emotional content of a story. You know, I think I'm dreading watching Hopkins do his role in The Father. I know I have to see it.
Right.
So close to my heart, and as I get older, and the whole notion of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and all of this kind of stuff.
Right.
I'm kind of putting it off.
Yeah, we just watched it. It's hard to watch.
You know, movies like 12 Years a Slave, there've been a whole pile of extraordinary filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
Even his small acts coming out of London. That whole thing about the restaurant and so on and the English cops. And I lived, you know, 10 years in England going to the Royal College. And that was my period. That was when I was in London, this late 60s, early 70s. But I've been lucky to travel extensively. I've been Africa, Far East, spent long time in Russia doing a series called Gerald Durrell in Russia. In Russia, about animal reserves and so on.
It's taking you all over the place.
Everywhere. And I don't think they send people quite to the same extent. Maybe the Vice team, who I have to say are an amazing group of cinematographers.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Brilliant and extraordinary work. Now that we've got the cameras down to being very small and unobtrusive, there's some amazing work being done on documentaries. And documentaries have their day now because of streaming.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I watched one this morning. I mean, yeah. I try to watch a documentary at least every 2 days, whereas they used to be very hard to find. But with streaming, they're everywhere. And they can have a life to them.
Listen, when I went to film school, we never saw a film at the Royal College. 3 years I was there, I never saw a movie because they didn't have the facilities for it.
Right, right.
I went after that to a school in Philadelphia, and there was a College of Art there, and they had a screening room, and they had a movie that had been sent to them in 12 cans from L.A. arrived in the screening room, and we watched this movie that had never been seen out because it was all about, I was a spy for the CIA during, it was Second World War propaganda.
Oh, got it. Right, right.
And nobody's seen those movies now. But now, how can you not be engrossed in cinematography and in movie making? It's everywhere and it's free and you just need to go there and click on your parents' thing and just go for it. It's so exciting. I think, too, so many people want to become cinematographers who are not going to have the means to go to a school.
Right.
But I had some kid just call me out of the blue, say, you shot a film called Brink for Disney. It was one of those things I did in the middle of 24.
Right.
And he said, that is far and away the best skateboard movie ever. It's not that old. I think he's only in high school.
Right.
He hasn't even told me what country he is now, but he nailed every point. And I wrote him back and I said, look, you want to know how we shot that? I said, it was a World War II gun camera called a Bell and Howell. And we put a motor on it that did 100-foot loads. Yeah. And I had a very, very good inline blade skater who just palmed it in his palm and put it right to the ground, crouched and could do the wheels and come all the way up and then push it into their faces. And that's how we shot all the skating with that camera.
Hmm.
It was amazing. And I had a guy on blades who was running a mic on them as well, or they were on radios, you know. And that was fantastic. And of course, when the 5D came out and everybody got to do skateboard videos with the little 5D, they were essentially doing the same thing that we'd done in 35 millimeter. But that movie holds up really well. It's just a shame it's in 4x3. It was before we went to 16x9.
Went to 16x9. Yeah.
Negatives, 4K.
Yeah.
But, Disney will never go back and redo it. But it's fun to see that on Disney Plus.
Sure, absolutely. And I think 24 was the first show I ever owned that was 16:9.
Yeah.
And
Everybody pushed for that.
Well, thank you. Thank you for doing that because
Well, it was an economic consideration. We were one of the first to adapt a Canadian invention called 3-perf.
Okay.
Which instead of pulling the film down 4 perforations vertically, you only pull 3 down. And then you get, instead of it being a 10-minute roll, it goes to 16 minutes in 1,000 foot. Or instead of being 4.5 minutes, it went to 6.5 minutes in the 400-foot mag.
Yeah.
And so that allowed us to, and of course, when you look at the frame in 3-perf, it is 16:9 by its very nature. So we didn't have any option. There it was. And they said, okay, fine, we'll take it. They used to clop the edges off, but then they took it. And we were already using $500,000 worth of film for processing every year.
Mm.
And Fox was mean as hell about that. They didn't know. Kiefer made the decision and said, no, not my face on this. So that
Wow.
Hey, there he is. Bless his heart.
I mean, Rodney, the passion for what you do just comes through so naturally. Is there something we should be looking out for that you're working on now? Or,
Nothing really at the moment. I've been talking to some Polish filmmakers about a movie called Aaliyah, and it's I think they'll get the money. They want about $5 million. We'll shoot Anamorphic in Poland.
Okay.
And I'm excited by that. I met them at Cameramage last 2019, and there are other things. I'm in development on a spy series called The Spy Master's Daughter.
Okay.
Kiefer and I own a script that we've been peddling for the longest time called My Father's Secret War, about a woman who woke up one day and realized her father had been a spy her whole life.
Wow.
Wow, CIA. That's interesting.
Yeah. Good stories. They need to be made. He was the first person to ever go into a concentration camp in Allied Germany, as the Allies swept through, recording everything came back, and he'd been a German scholar. He'd been to the University of Berlin before the war, and he burnt all his books.
Hmm.
And, she didn't realize until quite late in life when she would ask him a straight question, and he'd got Alzheimer's. He forgot that he had a security clearance. And so if she asked a trigger question, he would tell her what he did.
Wow.
He was in the OSS. He was dropped in behind enemy lines during the the Allied invasion.
And these are stories that need to be told.
Yes, it's particularly because he wrote an account, and he's actually in the museum in New York of intolerance on camera talking about going into this camp, because they were the first people to ever see the horrors of Nazi Germany.
The reality, yeah.
Camp called Ohrdruf. And the Allied command, 2 weeks later, sent everybody. Eisenhower and all the generals were there. There was cameras, video, film, everything. But it was the same day that FDR died, and so it never made the press.
Wow.
And it was subsequent camps that came to people's attention?
I had a grade five teacher that ignited my love for history, and certainly for that era. And yeah. And I'm less about the skirmishes and more about how did they get there? Like, how does a country get there? How do people? And again, as you said, the propaganda films, the marketing, all that kind of thing that was able to steer people to do some horrific and yeah. to accept horrific things has always fascinated me, as how we get there.
And, well, we're in very dangerous times with media, social media, and misinformation, and particularly in the digital ability to change people's faces and have them say things that they didn't say.
The deep fakes, yes. Yeah. Yeah, that is.
All of that tech is sitting on your laptop right now.
Yeah.
And it's going to be very, very challenging for my children and my children's children how they deal with this going forward.
Yeah, I agree. Well, Rodney, thank you so much. We have appreciated just hearing some great stories about everything that you've been involved with. And again, I personally thank you for being involved with Mantis, because that was a shining example of how it could be, to see where it comes to this many years later with a movie like Black Panther and those kind of things. Yes. But no, thank you for sharing with us your history with 24 and your history. And clearly, as I said, your passion for what you do comes through as you talk about it. So we appreciate you.
Yes, thank you so much. You give us some great insight on 24 and the cinematography around it and your role. So yeah, we appreciate learning all that, because it's a great angle to give the fans.
You made TV better.
Yes, you did.
Yeah.
Well, me and a bunch of people, I mean, about, mm-hmm. 50 or 60 key people from production design, wardrobe, hair, the whole thing. But they were part of our team, and everybody pulled their weight. They were all excited to be there, and we made great film.
And it's interesting, too, the through line through all of our discussions of everybody that was involved is that they were having fun. And even though it was grueling 16-hour days, people enjoyed themselves, and they still it comes through that they enjoyed themselves this many years later. That's a testament unto itself. So.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much.
There's a tiny little thing on the internet, of me dancing to Earth, Wind & Fire's September. We used to play it at the end of every day, and it was a time to kind of unwind. Real pleasure to do this. Thank you, guys.
Typical barrister.